Crickard was referring to former Chief Deputy D.A. Lynn Compton, who led the prosecution of Saran. But Compton had not personally investigated the Owen angle. He had relied on the LAPD reports, which, as we have seen, were doctored. It was a catch-22 dilemma for Bugliosi, but Crickard's mind was made up. The question of police malfeasance was out. Bill Powers was brought back into the courtroom. Quote, how many times did you speak to law enforcement in this case? Bugliosi asked him in defiance of the court's ruling. Crickard broke in. Mr. Bugliosi, that is exactly what we have talked about. We are not going to get into this area. With his major avenues of inquiry blocked by the judge, Bugliosi was forced to end his examination of Powers. Well, the last point we're going to take up on this broadcast concerns Judge Crickard's refusal to allow into evidence the CIA background of former SUS, well, he wasn't the head of SUS, but former SUS member, Lieutenant Manuel Peña. Peña, as I mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast, was in charge of overseeing the day-to-day investigation of the killing of Senator Kennedy. And both Lieutenant Manuel Peña and Sergeant Hank Hernandez had previously worked for the CIA under contract, and they had apparently functioned under the AID cover, and Peña had actually worked, the AID being the... Oh, God, my mind has just gone blank. The Association for International Development. There we go. Forgive me, dear people. Well, as I say, both Peña and Hernandez had worked for the CIA under AID cover, and they had actually worked with Dan Mitrione down in Latin America on assignment. The authors of the case, authors of the book, I should say, Turner and Christian describe Lieutenant Manuel Peña and Hank Hernandez's CIA background, saying, the choice of Lieutenant Manuel Peña for the key slot in SUS was a curious one. Among members of the force and the Mexican-American community, Peña was a living legend. Reputedly, he had killed 11 suspects in the line of duty, more than any other officer in the history of the department. In Special Unit Senator, Robert Houghton described him as a stocky, intense, proud man of Mexican-American descent with 22 years of experience under his belt at the time. Houghton boasted that Peña had commanded detective divisions, supervised a bank robbery squad, and spoke French and Spanish and had connections with various intelligence agencies in various countries. What we did not know at the time that Peña and Hernandez interrogated Jerry Owen was that both had long-standing connections with the CIA. Our first clue about Peña came months later when a faded newspaper article came to our attention. On November 13, 1967, more than 6 months before the RFK slaying, the San Fernando Valley Times had reported Peña's formal retirement from the LAPD. A surprise testimonial dinner was held in his honor at the Sportsman's Lodge, with LAPD Chief Thomas Redden, R-E-D-D-I-N, prominent among the law enforcement fraternity in attendance. It was a rousing and emotion-packed affair, unquote, the article said, and then quoted Redden, I have known Manny for many years. I would not have missed being here for anything, unquote. The article revealed, Peña retired from the police force to advance his career. He has accepted a position with the Agency for International Development Office of the State Department. As a public safety advisor, he will train and advise foreign police forces in investigative and administrative matters. After 9 weeks of training and orientation, he will be assigned to his post, possibly a Latin American country, judging by the fact that he speaks Spanish fluently. It is an open secret that the Office of Public Safety, this is Turner and Christian writing here, that this is not the San Fernando Valley Times article. It is an open secret that the Office of Public Safety of the Agency for International Development, AID, has long served as a cover for the CIA's clandestine program of supplying advisors and instructors for national police and intelligence services in Southeast Asia and Latin America engaged in anti-communist operations. In 1968, California Chief Deputy Attorney General Charles A. O'Brien informed us that this ultra-secret CIA unit was known to insiders as the Department of Dirty Tricks, unquote, and that one of its specialties was teaching foreign intelligence apparatus the techniques of assassination. FBI agent Roger LaJeunesse, LaJeunesse, whom Turner had known years before in the Bureau, confided that Peña had left the LAPD for a special training unit at a CIA base in Virginia. In fact, said LaJeunesse, Peña's departure in November 1967 had not been a one-shot deal. The detective had done CIA special assignments for a decade, mostly under AID cover. On some of these assignments in Central and South America, he worked with CIA operative Dan A. Mitrione, M-I-T-R-I-O-N-E, a former Indiana chief of police. Further confirmation of Peña's CIA role came from his brother, a high school teacher, who casually mentioned to television newsman Stan Borman how proud Manny was of his services for the CIA over the years. Reporter Fernando Fora, F-A-U-R-A, whose byline appeared on the newspaper story of the farewell banquet, recounted that in April 1968, only 5 months after Peña's departure, he was sauntering along a corridor in Parker Center when he spotted a vaguely familiar figure. The square face and fireplug frame seemed to belong to Manny Peña, but now he sported an expensive dark blue suit, a black handlebar mustache, and heavy, horn-rimmed glasses. Manny? Fora probed. The figure stopped and looked sheepish as the reporter approached with hand extended. Hey, Manny, I damn near didn't recognize you with that disguise. The detective was not amused. Fora asked what he was doing back in Los Angeles. Peña explained that the AID job wasn't quite what he expected, so he quit and resumed his duties with the LAPD. And we learned much later that Peña's SUS sidekick, Sergeant Hank Hernandez, who was promoted to lieutenant in recognition of his status in the special unit, also had CIA connections. Now retired from the force, he boasts in a resume offering his services as a private investigator that in 1963 he played a key role in Unified Police Command, unquote, training for the CIA in Latin America. He functioned under the usual cover of AID's Office of Public Safety and even received a medal from the Venezuelan government, then concerned with Fidel Castro's exportation of the Cuban Revolution. In retrospect, it seems odd that two policemen who doubled as CIA agents occupied key positions in SUS, where they were able to seal off avenues that led in the direction of a conspiracy. Well, when the KCOP versus Jerry Owen case came to trial, Vincent Bugliosi attempted to bring out the CIA background of Manny Peña, and once again, Judge Cricket was instrumental in blocking his actions. Bear in mind as you listen to this that, as I mentioned at the top of the broadcast, Thane Eugene Caesar, the man who it appears did actually kill Robert Kennedy, had previously worked at Lockheed's Burbank facility, which was closely affiliated with the CIA's U-2 project. Well, of Bugliosi's efforts to bring out Manny Peña's CIA background in court, Turner and Christian write, former Special Unit Senator Leader Manny Peña arrived at the courthouse after being subpoenaed by Bugliosi. We had briefed Bugliosi on his clandestine connection with the CIA, and the attorney agreed that the question of why this detective, of all the detectives on the LAPD, was picked for the key SUS position demanded an answer. Was he selected because of his CIA affiliation? What control might the CIA have exerted through him? What did SUS know about Bill Powers and the Cowboys? Was it SUS that had intimidated Powers into silence? Was there a cover-up? Peña was a vital witness if he could be opened up. Bugliosi approached Peña in the corridor and got an idea of what to expect. I'll be asking you on the witness stand if you've ever been associated in any fashion with the CIA, he said. No, I've never been associated with them, Peña asserted. Where did you get the idea that I was? Your brother told Stan Borman that you were proud of what you did for the CIA over the years. Did my brother say that? Peña said, frowning. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Bugliosi decided that in view of this bit of plausible deniability, to borrow the CIA's parlance, a little strategy was in order. Unless the judge allowed him to bear down on Peña, he would not get the answers he was seeking. Owen's lawyers had echoed their client's belief that there had been a conspiracy in the RFK case, although not one criminally involving Owen. Bugliosi called their hand. If that's what you believe, I don't want you to object to the CIA question being posed to Peña, he told the Owen lawyers before court resumed. So let's go back in chambers and talk to the judge. Back they trooped, informing Cricket of their agreement. Well, I have an objection, he grumbled. It's not relevant. It's extremely relevant, Bugliosi argued. They're obviously not covering up Saran's involvement, so what are they covering up? Cricket was adamant, falling back on his undue consumption of time plaint. Bugliosi flared. Well, we're spending all this time in your chambers arguing about it when we could settle it in court. But Cricket had the last word. It's not relevant, and I'm not going to let you do it. Court resumed with Manuel S. Peña raising his right hand to be sworn in. Lulling the judge, Bugliosi began with routine questions about his police career. Then he got to the, quote, retirement, unquote, banquet in 1967, which Peña confirmed. Bugliosi, but you continued to work at LAPD? Peña, no, I went with the U.S. State Department. I went to Washington, D.C. Bugliosi, is that the first time you had ever been associated with the State Department? Peña, correct. Bugliosi, were you trained back there at the State Department at all? Peña, I attended the Foreign Service Institute while I was back there. Bugliosi, did you ever go on assignment for the State Department? Peña, not at this time. Bugliosi, at a later time? Peña, I believe in the latter part of 69 and first part of 70, I took a trip to South America. Crickard finally caught on to Bugliosi's ploy and instructed him to move on to a relevant, unquote, area. This is his background, the attorney insisted. I want to know about his training and education. Bugliosi, why did you go to South America? Crickard, that is not relevant. Bugliosi, well, were you on assignment by the State Department in South America? Crickard, that is not relevant either. Let's get to this case. Bugliosi, I want to know whether it was a vacation or anything to do. He never got out the word CIA. Crickard cut in, directing Bugliosi to the Jerry Owen inquiry that the witness had supervised. Question. Was the truck ever checked for fingerprints to ascertain whether Saran's prints were inside? Pena. I couldn't say that without going back to the files. I can't at this moment. Bugliosi. That would have been the normal thing to do, right? Pena. Normal. Routine. But I can't tell you that it was without going back through the files. According to Pena's testimony, Special Unit Senator concluded that Owen was neither with Saran in the truck nor implicated in the assassination. The details eluded him due, he said, to the passage of time. Bugliosi took one more stab at pinning down his covert CIA activities, asking, Mr. Pena, throughout your law enforcement career, have you ever worked directly or indirectly for the CIA? Pena sat in stony silence. Crickard, so angered that his gavel hand trembled, loudly interjected, You don't have to answer that. That's not relevant in this case. The court discussed that with you in chambers, Mr. Bugliosi, and told you not to inquire into that area, unquote. After a brief exchange with the judge, Bugliosi tried another tack. You indicated earlier that you worked for the State Department, he addressed Pena. Was this on a paid basis or was it? Crickard burst in again. That's not relevant either. You don't have to answer that question. The door was closed. Insofar as the court was concerned, Manny Pena wore striped pants and a Homburg instead of a cloak and dagger. But Bugliosi had already gotten in the back door a good portion of what Crickard had forbidden him to elicit directly. Why was an LAPD officer attending the Foreign Service Institute, a CIA cover front outfit, and on assignment to South America for the State Department, unquote?
Okay, and that was a couple of segments from Hard Rain and going over the KCOP versus Jerry Owen trial. And I hope that that illuminated some of the problems inherent. One would think, of course, one of the things people have always said about the John F. Kennedy assassination is, well, if the case had only gotten to court, if Lee Harvey Oswald had lived, and which of course would suggest why Lee Harvey Oswald perhaps did not live, but if Lee Harvey Oswald had lived and they'd gotten the case into a court, well, justice would have been done, right? Well, as you can see, the case with Judge Crickard and the folks at work down in Los Angeles, that no matter how hard Vincent Bugliosi tried, he was prevented at virtually every turn from introducing any of this information into the record. Of course, the Kennedy assassination, the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, goes virtually still. I guess you'd have to say unsolved today, although a man is in prison for the crime. The man now himself believes that he did it, and most of the public seems to believe he did it, too.
Again, it's physically impossible for him to have done it, according to the account provided by all of the eyewitnesses to the situation, as well as the massive cover-up indicating that somebody other than Saran did it, and somebody very powerful or some very powerful people were going out of their way to try and make it look like Saran did it.
Much has happened in the John F. Kennedy case, of course. One of the main reasons that these kinds of courtroom shenanigans were able to go forth and go through was the fact that, of course, the news media, once again, tended to respond in a sluggish and, in many cases, plainly inaccurate or self-serving manner. And we're going to read a little bit more about that in just a moment.
All righty. Now, hopefully you've got this material on tape because there's so many connections, and I would advise sitting down and drawing lines between these to connect them. The last thing we'd like to present on this broadcast, so many key political figures, both the national and state level, were involved in the Robert Kennedy assassination. It's perhaps the single most important aspect of the case. We'd just like to wind up by relating the roles played by a couple of rising stars on the California political horizon. One of the figures involved in covering up during the later stages of the investigation of the Robert Kennedy assassination, a person who had a lot to do with deep-sixing the efforts in the mid-70s to bring the case to justice, was a fellow who at the time had succeeded Evel Younger as district attorney for the city of Los Angeles, and since then has succeeded Evel Younger with George Duke Majian in between as attorney general for the state of California, namely John Vandekamp. Christian and Turner, in the assassination of Robert Kennedy, recite Vandekamp's role in covering up the assassination of Robert Kennedy. The Krantz referred to here as special counsel for the district attorney, Thomas Krantz, K-R-A-N-Z. Krantz had been commissioned by the Board of Supervisors to conduct an independent investigation to see if the LAPD and the DA's office were correct in their conclusions on the RFK case. yet Kranz actually became part of the DA's office and was on their payroll. Furthermore, he and Dinko Bozanic, another deputy district attorney assigned to assist Kranz, were taking orders from their boss, District Attorney John Van de Kamp. And Van de Kamp was doing what he has proven to be very adept at, talk to different audiences different ways on the same subject. To the news media, he proclaimed that he wanted, quote, to get to the bottom of the RFK case, unquote. But in the courtroom where it counted, his own deputies Kranz and Bozanic were fighting tooth and nail at Van de Kamp's insistence to discourage Judge Wenke from continuing the inquiry. Judge Wenke, recall, presiding over the L.A. County Board of Supervisors forensic or ballistics experts. We talked about that panel early in the broadcast.
Okay, going on again to the activities of certain people in the district attorney's office, and also, as mentioned earlier, the role of the news media, which we do see time and time again crops up in these cases. For the Los Angeles Times, whose ruling Chandler family wield enormous power in Los Angeles through their paper, the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy struck close to home. The candidate had been fatally shot in one of the city's landmark hotels. The case had been investigated by the Los Angeles Police Department, and Sirhan had been tried and convicted by Los Angeles prosecutors. As the Times saw it, the local institutions of government had performed well, unlike the shambles of Dallas. So when Vince Bugliosi declared himself a candidate for district attorney in August 1975, only weeks after the Owen versus KCOP trial, the Times raised its editorial voice in opposition to the prodigal son who wanted to reopen the RFK case. The DA vacancy was created when Joe Bush had died suddenly a month earlier, and the County Board of Supervisors was considering a list of 11 candidates for the interim appointment. In his turn before the supervisors, Bugliosi stated that if selected, he would launch a tough program against organized crime, try to get vicious criminals off the streets while preventing police harassment of those exercising First Amendment rights, and prosecute industrial polluters and corporations engaged in consumer fraud. The DA's office had always trod softly in those areas because members of the very establishment controlling Los Angeles politics were implicated. Bugliosi also promised to take steps to get at the actual facts in the RFK case. He said that he would name a blue ribbon scientific task force to re-examine the evidence from top to bottom. He would assemble a team of top investigators and prosecutors in the DA's office to, quote, examine and analyze the entire investigative files of the LAPD, and issue a public invitation for all persons having information, including law enforcement officers, to come forward under a cloak of anonymity. He would ask the supervisors to help convene a special grand jury to hear the testimony of witnesses whose evidence contradicted the lone assassin conclusion. He would cooperate with congressional committees that might look into the case and open a, quote, positive line of communication with the citizenry after years of secrecy. 5 years earlier, one of the Times' frontline reporters, Dave Smith, had recommended that the newspaper commit limited resources and backing to help our investigation process, our meaning the authors. Contact with the Times had been made by our original benefactor, Peter Hitchcock of San Francisco, who interceded with his close friend, Otis Chandler, the publisher. Editor Bill Thomas assigned Smith to vet our files and submit a recommendation, but after Smith urged a go-ahead, nothing happened. When he persisted, he was at first ignored, then belittled, and finally shunted to a minor slot. On August 20th, 1975, the Times editorialized, quote, one interpretation of all this, meaning Bugliosi's pronouncements on the RFK case, is that Bugliosi believes he has an emotional issue that he can exploit next summer in the election for a full-term district attorney. Bugliosi fired back an indignant letter that read in part, quote, for you to insinuate that my personal commitment to help resolve this controversy is selfish and politically motivated is an affront to my professional integrity. It is truly unfortunate that on the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, the editors at the Times are apparently out of touch with this community's attitude about this issue and totally unaware of the concerned mood of the entire country.
Continuing, it was no surprise when the supervisors passed over Bugliosi and settled on a compromise candidate, bakery heir John Van de Kamp. Although he had never even prosecuted a rape or murder case, Van de Kamp had more important credentials. His family were close to the Chandler family of the Times. When Bugliosi contested Van de Kamp in the 1976 election, he had a high degree of name recognition through Helter Skelter, which had eclipsed In Cold Blood as the best-selling crime book of all time. But that was about all. The establishment saw him as someone they could not control and closed ranks behind Van de Kamp, whose war chest brimmed with money. Even Attorney General Evel Younger, who as a Republican might have been expected to stay out of a fight among Democrats, was so anxious to keep the lid on the RFK case that he endorsed Van de Kamp. Recall that Evel Younger was the corrupt prosecutor who had covered up the Ceron case, the assassination of Robert Kennedy. The establishment's fear of Bugliosi was so great that they even succeeded in pressuring CBS into blacking out the entire Los Angeles area for the airing of the TV movie based on Bugliosi's book, Helter Skelter. The Times naturally favored Vandekamp, but exceeded the bounds of fair play by not reporting Bugliosi's press announcements and publishing critical attacks on him instead. When actor Robert Vaughn and Jocelyn Brando, Marlon's sister, wrote a letter protesting the manner in which the Times, quote, has been using its editorial pages and reporters to attack our friend and candidate with a brand of journalism that is below the dignity of this community, unquote, the newspaper refused to publish it. So Vaughn, remembered from The Man from U.N.C.L.E. in the recent television special Washington Behind Closed Doors, was left to make his point to 1,000 people at a fundraising dinner at the Hollywood Palladium. Vince Bugliosi alone, Vaughn told his audience in an emotional speech, has committed himself to resolve the very serious and disturbing questions that have arisen about the death of my good friend Robert Kennedy, whose murder 8 years ago in this very city surely changed the course of American history. Vandekamp's public position was that he was not intractable but would have to see proof. 6 weeks before the election, veteran CBS correspondent Bill Stout plunked down on his desk a set of FBI photographs with captions, the same photographs that showed extra bullet holes in the hotel pantry. The DA, this meaning Vandekamp, stared at them, unwilling or unable to answer Stout's rhetorical questions about their significance, then called FBI Director Clarence Kelly in Washington. Kelly said he didn't know anything about the photographs, but would check. He called back to say that the FBI had not conducted any ballistics investigation in the case, which was a semantic dodge. Vandekamp assured Stout that he would look into it and let him know. Stout is still waiting. So not only the performance there of John Vandekamp, but also of the entire establishment of the city of Los Angeles, especially the L.A. Times, in blocking Vincent Bugliosi's ascendancy to the district attorney from which Bugliosi planned to reopen the Robert Kennedy investigation. Now, the last, I guess, rising star on the California political horizon that we're going to look into very briefly in connection with the Robert Kennedy assassination is former Chief of Police Ed Davis. Ed Davis is now a state senator. Apparently, he has gubernatorial aspirations, and significantly, Ed Davis's office is being used as a base by Lieutenant former General Daniel Graham for his High Frontier program pushing the Star Wars, and of course, Graham's partner in that is the mysterious Fritz Kramer, the strange German who is Henry Kissinger's mentor. Okay, so Ed Davis, a rising star on the California political horizon, and in the Robert Kennedy assassination, Ed Davis was basically establishing a command post in the Rampart Station where Sam Yorty went rousting about and pulling up evidence and then held his press conference painting Ceron red and, of course, violating the law in so doing.
Yes, and as it mentions in the book here in a footnote, Davis was acting chief of police on the night of the RFK assassination, headquartered at Rampart Station as, quote, watch commander. He was still on duty after midnight, an unusually lengthy period for such a high-level LAPD official. So the acting chief of police was serving as watch commander and, again, the station where Sam Yorty staged his red-baiting attacks and a lot of sort of became rumor central for the Sirhan as a communist brigade. And, of course, Ed Davis today is still doing that kind of work and has been for many years in Southern California. Okay, well, getting about 11:25 at night, a very long broadcast. We hope that we didn't catch you folks as unaware as we caught ourselves and that those of you who are taping had time to tape this information. Anyway, just want to let you know that we are going out. We're going out the door right now. We appreciate you being with us. We wish we had had things slightly better organized and would have had time to take some phone calls. But, of course, we do have One Step Beyond on Sunday nights from 8 until 11 o'clock when you can phone if you want to ask some questions about these things. And we'll be back next month with a Radio Free America dealing with the Aryan Nations and related topics.
Right. Mae Brussel, by the way, her tape 703 will air tomorrow at 9 p.m. And it's a custom slot. And, again, sorry for the length of this. In the future of the broadcast, we're going to try and keep them a little shorter, and if we get a big topic like this, we'll do two or three rather than trying to cram it all into one show. But again, these programs are made to be taped. It's sort of a way of, it's sort of like oral books or news articles. It's a way of giving you some of the stuff to bite on for yourself so you can really get down and grapple with this material and come to terms with it.
Okay, so once again, this is Nep Tuck speaking for myself and Dave Emery, thanking you for joining us on Radio Free America, and we will see you soon right here on KFJC.